Many of you have already heard this sound today. For me, it was a seltzer. The main ingredient in soft drinks, carbonated water, has been around for a couple of centuries, but scientists are still trying to figure out exactly how we experience the fizz of bubbly drinks. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has this story on a new study examining cells in our tongues that respond to carbonation.
Lots of people drink sodas every day, but Nick Reba is not one of them. He says he probably drinks less than one carbonated beverage per week.
I'm a simple person. I drink ordinary tap water normally.
But he studies how people perceive tastes and became curious about the sensations produced by liquids loaded with carbon dioxide.
When you drink a carbonated drink, you really think that you're detecting the bubbles bursting on your tongue, don't you?
But Reba says there's some evidence that the fizzy feeling isn't just bursting bubbles. People have been asked to drink carbonated beverages inside pressure chambers set up so that no bubbles can form.
The sensation you get is actually the same.
And that wasn't the only hint that bubbles weren't the whole story.
Another finding that was very interesting was that carbon dioxide produced strong nerve responses and taste nerves.
That intrigued Reba, who works at the National Institutes of Health. He collaborated with Charles Zucker, who's now at Columbia University, to explore how carbon dioxide acts on the taste system. First, using mice, they confirmed that plain old club soda did generate a response in a nerve that carries signals from the tongue's taste receptor cells. Then they did similar experiments using mice that don't have specific cells required to sense different tastes, like sour or sweet.
And in particular, we found that mice that are unable to respond to sour stimuli were unable to detect carbon dioxide with their taste system.
So these sour-sensing cells must be involved in the sensation of fizzy drinks. It turns out that these cells have an enzyme on their surface that interacts with carbon dioxide in a way that creates acidity. The cell then responds, as it normally does, to sour flavors.
So that's why we think carbon dioxide causes a taste response.
The results have just been reported in the journal Science. Earl Carstens has studied carbonation at the University of California, Davis. He says when he drinks a soda, he usually thinks of it as a burning or tingling sensation. And he says carbonation is known to stimulate nerves for things like touch or pain.
But this paper says there's also a distinctive taste component that you should be aware of, too. And it's distinctly different from just regular water. There's a carbonation taste, which is probably a slightly sour, has a sour component to it.
He says he's not surprised that this particular acid-producing enzyme plays a role. This enzyme is blocked by a drug for altitude sickness, and it's long been known that mountain climbers taking the drug can be disappointed when they get to the top and gulp a celebratory drink.
They noticed that when they drank beer or other fizzy drinks, the drinks no longer had a fizzy or tingling sensation, and they tended to taste like dishwater.
Carstens says it's not clear why the body's sensory system might have evolved to have a carbonation detector on taste cells.
I guess one reason would be if there's like rotting food that's giving off CO2 gas, you might want to be able to detect that. But otherwise, it's not entirely clear.
The deeper meaning of carbonation may be a puzzle for researchers, but for beverage manufacturers, its value is a no-brainer.
Americans spend about $73 billion a year on sodas.
John Sisher is editor and publisher of a trade publication called Beverage Digest. He says if you look at the kind of things Americans drink,
the largest category is carbonated soft drinks. It's about twice the size of the second biggest category, which is beer, then bottled water, and then milk.
So, even if scientists say that carbonation triggers sour tastes, pain receptors, and perhaps even some kind of ancient alarm for rotting food, there must be some reason we keep reaching for fizzy drinks. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
One problem of accounting for carbon is trying to figure out how much carbon goes into forests and comes out again. That's important because forests could become carbon banks, as they're called, storing carbon and keeping it out of the atmosphere. The legislation pending in Congress would pay people to grow trees, but as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, carbon banking is a tricky business.
The idea is simple. grow more forests or save existing ones, and you curb climate change. Growing trees suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it in wood and roots. Dead or burned trees release CO2 into the air. Forests have become a great green hope for curbing global warming. For one thing, growing them is usually cheaper than reducing emissions from factories and power plants. The rub is in the accounting. How much carbon will forests store and for how long? Let's say you let a forest grow unchecked. That puts a lot of carbon in the bank. But western U.S. forests can become tinderboxes. Here's forest ecologist Matthew Herto from Northern Arizona University.
Without regular surface fire, the litter, branches, coarse woody debris build up over time, and then when fire does occur, end up releasing more energy and carbon.
Frequent small fires keep the woody debris down. That's why foresters regularly start them on purpose to keep those huge fires from happening later on. But any fire puts CO2 into the air. So do frequent small fires put more or less carbon into the atmosphere than the occasional massive fire?
You know, that is really a question that we're looking for the answer to right now.
Herto's research in the Sierra Nevada mountains suggests that one way to keep fires to a minimum and still store lots of carbon is to return those forests to what they were 150 years ago. Large trees growing in patches, lots of space between them, and fewer small trees. But no one knows for sure. Forests may also grow differently in the future. It's already warmer, and climate scientists say it will keep getting warmer. Gregory Latta is a forest economist at Oregon State University who studied how northwestern forests might be affected by warming. In some places, warming could slow growth, and that means less carbon in the bank.
At the lower elevations, they have moisture, and as you crank up the temperature in the growing season, that moisture evaporates, and so it's kind of taking away from them a little bit.
Latta adds that a warmer climate would probably have the opposite effect on higher altitude forests. They grow faster. In the end, northwestern forests might see overall increases, but that may not apply elsewhere.
So you can't really put this broad brush across the whole area and say, here's the impact of climate change. It's going to really impact different areas depending on what their starting point was.
Then there's another trend to watch, drought. Climate models predict the West will get drier. David Brashears at the University of Arizona says scientists are seeing more dead and dying trees already.
So there's the potential for kind of a double whammy between having warmer temperature and drought, which could trigger fire or tree die-off, and that'll pose a challenge in terms of how much carbon can you store in a system.
Brashears says scientists don't really know yet how forests will store carbon for a potential climate bank, as well as deliver timber, provide a home for wildlife, and not burn up too often. In fact, one of the first experiments to manage a forest carbon bank has already run into trouble. 12 years ago, the Nature Conservancy and the Bolivian government set aside a forest in Bolivia called Noel Kempf Mercado. They closed down sawmills and stopped cutting timber. Experts predicted that over 30 years, they would reduce CO2 from deforestation by 55 million tons. Now, they say, it's more like 5.5 million tons. That's not a failure, though, say experts at the Conservancy. They simply know more now about storing carbon in trees, knowledge they can share with others planning similar carbon banks. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
We have a reminder this morning of just how complicated it can be to fight global warming. Anti-global warming rules, now in effect, may actually encourage people to cut down forests. That news comes just as we prepare for a lot of talk about climate change. The Senate is debating an energy bill next week, and in December, Copenhagen will host a global conference on climate. Officials may have to give thought to a finding in today's Science magazine. It focuses on biofuels, which are made from plants. Current laws on biofuels have unintended consequences, which in turn make climate change worse. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
If you burn ethanol from corn in your car, the government doesn't count the carbon dioxide that comes out the tailpipe as an actual carbon emission. That's because they figure the corn plant originally took that carbon dioxide out of the air, so you're just putting it back. But 13 prominent scientists point out in Science magazine that's bad logic when it comes to many types of biofuels. Author Tim Searchinger is from Princeton University, and he offers an extreme example to make the point.
Even if you were to cut down the world's forests and turn them into a parking lot and take the wood and put it in a boiler, which obviously releases enormous amounts of carbon in the trees, that is treated as a pure way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And that's obviously an error.
And that error isn't trivial. It's now enshrined in European law as well as the Kyoto Climate Treaty.
The problem is that when the world agreed to a treaty that limited the amount of carbon that goes up the smokestack, they didn't agree to limit the amount of carbon released by cutting down trees.
Sertinger explains that in an effort to avoid double counting carbon emissions, the treaty negotiators ended up with a system that never counts them at all. And he says the climate bill that passed the U.S. House of Representatives earlier this year makes basically the same error, though at the moment the Senate bill does have forest safeguards in place. As a result of this accounting error, countries trying to reduce their carbon emissions actually have an incentive to cut down forests and burn them up or replant the area with biofuels crops. In fact, Sertinger says power plants in Northern Europe are starting to chip up wood and burn it for energy in the name of reducing emissions.
The fundamental effect of this flaw is to make forests worth more dead than alive.
This spring, another report in Science magazine pondered what would happen in the coming decades if biofuels carbon was never counted as an emission. Jay Edmonds at the Pacific Northwest National Lab says they calculated that almost all the world's forests would be chopped down by the middle of this century.
You can't actually imagine this thing going on like this with no one noticing and no one stepping in to intervene, but the numerical experiment is instructive in that it takes the phenomena into sharp relief.
The good news is it's very easily fixable.
Again, Tim Sertinger. He says nations simply need to count all carbon dioxide coming out of tailpipes and smokestacks, regardless of the source. Then, if the source of the biofuel was a destructive one, like deforestation, there would be no carbon emissions credit. But if it was from a good source, like plants grown on previously barren land, that would earn a carbon credit.
So there are substantial amounts of bioenergy we can make that do give us greenhouse gas benefits. What we don't want to do is create a false and perverse incentive simply to go clear the world's forests.
Whether this new accounting scheme would affect the domestic biofuels industry is debatable. Bob Dineen, president of the Renewable Fuels Association, says it shouldn't matter.
Some of the points that have been made in the paper today we agree with. You should never, under any circumstance, tear down a forest for the growing of a biofuel.
But some scientists argue that the domestic biofuels industry does indirectly lead to deforestation in the tropics by raising the global price of corn and encouraging farmers in South America to clear land to plant grain. Jay Edmonds from the Pacific Northwest National Lab says if we could place a cash value on preserving forests, that ends up being good for the atmosphere.
You end up not producing quite as much biofuel, but then you don't need as much because you don't have to make up for the deforestation.
The real challenge now, Edmonds says, is figuring out how to put a new carbon accounting system into practice. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Here's some real music to your ears. Musical training can improve your hearing. That's the conclusion of several studies presented today in Chicago before the Society for Neuroscience. The studies found that serious musicians can perceive and remember sounds better than the rest of us. And as NPR's John Hamilton reports, it's not because they have better ears.
Sounds come in through the ears, but they travel through our nerves and get interpreted by our brains. Nina Kraus, who directs the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern University, says that means your hearing can change even if your ears don't.
Your hearing system becomes tuned by the experiences that you have had with sound throughout your life.
Kraus figured the hearing systems of musicians ought to be more finely tuned than those of other people. So she tested their ability to do something that's challenging for most of us, understanding what someone is saying in a noisy room. 15 classically trained musicians and 16 non-musicians listened to a simple sentence. First, they heard it without any background noise.
Sugar is very sweet.
Then, against a backdrop of quiet conversations.
Sugar is very sweet.
And finally, competing with some pretty loud conversations. Standard hearing tests had shown that the musicians' ears weren't any more sensitive than other listeners. But Krauss knew that their brains, shaped by years of training, had become very good at a similar task.
A musician will be listening to the sound of his own instrument, even though many other instruments are playing.
Not unlike separating one voice from a crowd of voices.
So we wondered, would this skill, which involves your hearing, would it transfer from the music domain into the speech domain? And resoundingly it does.
Krauss says a closer look at musical brains may explain why. Tests show that sounds produce stronger electrical signals in musicians' brain stems, and these signals offer a more accurate representation of pitch, timing, and tone quality, three things that help us pick out a single voice in a noisy room. Another study presented at the neuroscience meeting suggests musical training could help children who are struggling with language.
These kids seem to be impaired in the very areas that musicians excel.
Dana Strait is a PhD candidate in Krauss's lab at Northwestern. She's also studied the oboe and piano for many years. Strait asked musicians and non-musicians to take a simple test.
They were asked to click a button every time they heard a specific sound, but not click a button to other sounds that they might hear.
Musicians not only responded faster and more accurately, they were able to stay focused longer. Many children with dyslexia and other language problems do poorly on tests like this. Strait thinks musical training offers a way to improve their performance.
Musical experience can change how our brain interacts with sounds. It's almost like the brain's able to better pay attention to sound and better extract meaning from sound.
That makes sense if you think about the brain and the hearing system as if they were muscles. Mark Jude Tramo is a neurologist at Harvard and directs the Institute for Music and Brain Science.
The way a tennis player is very good at arm wrestling with their tennis hand because their forearms are so strong, a musician who exercises that part of the brain is going to be able to do better on any task that involves auditory concentration.
Tramo says Aristotle wanted music to be part of the Greek educational system because he believed it improved the mind. Now, brain scientists have biological evidence that he was onto something. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Crickets, it turns out, can distinguish one species from the next by the pattern of its chirping. Laurel Symes is a researcher from Dartmouth College who records and even travels with crickets.
Yeah, I try and keep them in cardboard boxes, like I close up the boxes while I'm driving in the car. As you keep driving, you'll hear one start and then two starts, and pretty soon your whole car is full of chirping crickets, and then you hit a bump and they stop. And so it just, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne said that tree crickets are the sound of silence made audible. Well, he hasn't driven a couple hundred miles with them. They make their sound by rubbing their two front wings together, and so they have something that looks like a man's comb on one side, and then just kind of a hard surface on the other side. And so they rub this thing across, and it goes, drink, drink, drink. But they do it so fast that all we hear is this continuous noise. As far as we know, they really just call to attract females or to keep a little territory. That's called the snowy tree cricket. It's also called the thermometer tree cricket because you can actually count the number of chirps in 13 seconds, add 40, and you can get the temperature in Fahrenheit that way. When you slow that down even more, you know, it goes chirp, chirp, chirp. Within each chirp, there are actually eight separate pulses. So it goes din, 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 din. Din, 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 din. And if we were to speed that up to normal speed, what that would sound like is chirp, chirp. So that's Acanthus rileyi, and that's a Western species. And when you slow those chirps down, each individual chirp is actually 11 separate pulses, so that you hear 2, 3, 3, 3. They're just these little tiny insects, but you know they have temperature dependence and the physical acoustics of their wings and you know, all these million years of evolution in this little tiny insect. I guess I've fallen in love.
Our sounds come via the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Thanks to NPR's Christopher Joyce for finding them. For more about chirping crickets, visit our website at npr.org.
Nuni mi foka itati ni lati mi kunda fatika tishua Manduna katifu waini Manyanzu katifalini Miyanzu katiragarani Ankaizamu, ankaizamu, ankaizamu Ankaizami nefatifiti nefamitina